The new book, The Art of Dying Well, is about living as well as possible for as long as possible and adapting successfully to change. Journalist and prominent end-of-life speaker Katie Butler shows how to thrive in later life, how to get the best from our health system, and how to make your own good death more likely. The book is a handbook of step-by-step preparations, practical, communal, physical, sometimes spiritual, to help us make the most of our remaining time, be it decades, years, or months. The new book is The Art of Dying Well, and it's a pleasure to welcome Katie Butler to the roundtable this morning. Katie, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Joe. I'm really happy to be here.
It is very nice to have you on the program. What got you thinking about what dying well meant?
I suppose the fact that my father did not die well. He had a very prolonged decline, and that decline was made worse, in our family's opinion, because he'd been given a pacemaker, which we felt deprived him of a natural death at a time when he would have welcomed that. So I was already a journalist, and I just was curious about what had changed in the nature of dying, and I ended up writing a whole book about our family's experience, but it was more a book about the problems of modern death, and I really wanted to write a book about solutions because so many people were coming to me and saying one or another bad situation that they were trying to confront and work with.
Is the statement I'm about to say true, which is your case of dying poorly may be different than my case of dying poorly, in the sense of my definition of what dying well means would be different than someone else's definition of dying well?
Absolutely. I think almost all of us are agreed that having our loved ones around us, being relatively comfortable and free from pain and clean at the time of death, are very important. For a lot of people, it's very important to have some sense of dignity or even a sense of the sacred, and not to feel they're dying at the hands of strangers in a highly technological environment. We're not all agreed on everything, and 23% of people want to live as long as possible no matter what. But the other 75% or so have other goals that are more important to them than that. Also, there are many different forms of bad death. My dad's case, it was a pacemaker. In another family, it might be a decision about something like dialysis. We're also very different from person to person in how much suffering we're willing to put up with in return for more time on Earth, and with our moral values and our religious values, which may determine those questions as well.
It seems as though that for many people, the decisions come much later than they probably should be made. And yet, there is also the problem of getting people to make those decisions earlier because they don't want to think about it. How do you, in the guide, how do you look at those issues of getting people to think? Because you talk about in the 50s and 60s of your life to really sit down and think about these issues.
Yes, I think it's a multi-pronged problem. One part of the problem is that doctors do not alert patients early in the process of an incurable illness about where things are heading and where they are on that trajectory. So I have a number of recommendations, and they start, frankly, with the spiritual. Almost every meaningful, large-scale religion recommends that the spiritually mature person contemplate the possibility of death long before it occurs. And I include in the book some beautiful prayers, in essence, from various religions. So there's that aspect, just culturally and emotionally integrating into our own thinking the fact that we are going to die someday. And then there's the question of opening up to our doctors about what we really value, and really coaching our doctors to tell us, frankly, what's going on. It's a terrible sadness to me that large numbers of people with stage 4 cancers do not hear the news of where things are heading from their own oncologists. They hear them instead in an emergency room from a doctor they have never met before. They hear that they're dying and that they should go on hospice.
Why is that the case, do you think? What is it about the oncologists that
that is, there's obviously they want the hope, but there's also the practical.
Exactly. Because when we have clarity about where we are in our process, we can plan and we can be empowered and we can have a vision of how we would like our last weeks or months to go. We can take the opportunity to thank people, to ask for forgiveness, to forgive others, and to express our love for people. All of these are very important emotional tasks of the end of life, and they help our survivors not be traumatized in the aftermath of our death. So it's very important to get this heads up. The reason that oncologists don't give it is several. One is they're very poorly trained in it. Another is they feel like failures and they feel like they're abandoning their patients when they say these things. Another is, unfortunately, their patients often give them bad marks if they are truthful. So we have a problem on both sides of the fence. We have a problem as individuals and members of our culture who are just patients and regular people. And then there's the problem from the medical side, which is this failure of training, these fears and emotions of the doctors themselves, and the fact that we have a reimbursement system that, for example, with cancer, reimburses oncologists by giving them a percentage of the price of the chemos they administer. And it funds them very poorly for having long emotional conversations with their patients about where things are heading. So we've got these perverse incentives that really are telling our oncologists that as a society, we care more about the chemo than about the conversation.
Having lost both my parents, I've been through two different situations, and I have two stories that came out of each event. And I learned so much from those. One was with my father, who passed at the age of 86. And after a very back and forth with various lung disease and infection, but lived a very good life. What fascinated me about that was that there were many times that he would be going in for surgery or for various treatments, and we would talk about what he wanted. And it was very clear, the directive. It was written down of what the directive was, of what he wanted, which was not to prolong his life in any meaningful way. And yet there would be those times right before or right after surgery when the nurse would ask, you know, what do you want? And he would counter what had been written down. And yeah. It put us all in a very weird position, and we didn't know what to do. And we're like, oh, you know what? We have never read about that one. Now, now what do we do?
Exactly. We think of these as very binary decisions. It's going to be very black and white, like, don't put me in intensive care, don't hook me up to machines. But the real truth is we have what I call a prolonged gray zone between active living and active dying, where things are not so clear. They're very uncertain. Doctors can't predict well in that time period how long you have left, for example. So we're actually making this series of micro decisions, not one big decision. And this makes it very difficult, and I think for families, we also have to forgive ourselves because we are working with these very broken and fragmented medical systems, and that makes decision-making more difficult. I do believe that if you can, this is part of the purpose for writing the book, that if you can give people some positive images and an imagination of a pathway to a good death, rather than simply, well, either we give you this one more treatment or you're facing some blank wall that we have not explained to you or reassured to you about. So one of the questions in the section of the book that I have called Awareness of Mortality, I suggest you actually ask your doctor very flatly, what is it like to die of my disease, and what can medicine do to ease those symptoms? Because different deaths have very, very different pathways and kind of signature trajectories, and some of them are quite peaceful, like kidney failure death is, on the whole, quite a peaceful death. And there are others that are quite peaceful, and others where you need a lot more medical intervention to make them bearable and not painful. And we can know about these things if we ask about it.
that's a great point, that you can know about these things if you ask about it. The other story actually has to do with that, which was when my mother had a stroke and a very severe stroke, and the doctors were, this goes back to your point about the oncologist, but the doctors were making very sort of general statements as to what we should be doing and caring and so forth, but there was no timeline given. There was no, like, what could happen here? And I remember later in the process of just asking the doctor a very key question, which was, how long have you been a doctor? Mm-hmm. The answer was 18 years. In your experience, what is the longest you've seen someone live in this condition? And the answer was 7 days. Okay. Now,
oh, wow.
Now I know. Now I know.
That's a brilliant, I'm going to have to revise my book. No, I mean, those are great questions.
And I just thought to myself, you know, because we're not dealing with the tangible. We're just dealing with these ideas of rehabilitation, and not putting any sort of time stamp on it. And sometimes that can be very helpful because obviously, I mean, we were putting beds in the house and rewiring the whole thing to try to get my mom back home, only to realize that probably wouldn't happen.
Yeah. I think those are brilliant questions. And another question that I think is brilliant is knowing what your mother would consider a good quality of life.
Right.
And asking what were the chances of her ever being returned to that quality of life. Because I think actually the key question is not how long can she live if we do everything. The question is, if we do everything, can we restore her to health?
And this is even, in that case, we knew what she wanted. But what it was is that the system would say, okay, but we've done what we can for her. So now she has to move to another facility. And is this short term or is this long term? And that's where we got into where, to me, the time span was very important. And what we could do to make that more meaningful for us and, of course, for her.
I'm so glad you got to ask that question and that you got an honest answer out of it. And I also want to reflect to you the broken nature of our systems. I think it is so unfair to families and to dying people to say, well, a little earlier in your disease process, we're going to make you have 8 different ologists that you are going to have to hop from one silo to another to see, like your cardiologist, your nephrologist, your neurologist. So that's enough splitting up of the human being into diagnoses. And then we're also splitting it in the timeline and saying, okay, if you're early in the disease process, you're going to see your oncologist. But when it comes time to start shifting toward planning for a good death or comfort care, we're going to make you relate to somebody completely different, your palliative care doctor. And then, as in your mother's case, if it turns out we're going to have some kind of long-term custodial care, we're going to shift her to yet another system. This is very inhumane, and it explains in part why people are suffering so much trauma in the wake of a death. But I want to make something clear. This book is actually very hopeful.
It is.
It's got lots and lots of stories in it of people rising to the occasion, sometimes in difficult situations, and really helping people they love have very good deaths. And even in hospitals, even in intensive care units, bringing a sense of the sacred and a sense of community into the room and having the experience be an experience of death, of depth and of honor, and not merely a technologically rich and emotionally poor environment.
Katie Butler is a journalist and a prominent end-of-life speaker. Her new book is The Art of Dying Well.
Talk a little bit about that, bringing a sense of sacred to a hospital death. I mean, that is what we ended up with for my mother, which was beautiful. And it was one of the most gorgeous things I've ever seen. And you're right. This is a hopeful book, and it's getting everyone to that point, though, right? I mean, you have to get the patient, to get the family, to get the doctors, to get everybody to that point where we're all ready to let go.
Well, and this is just a truism of human life, that people who accept what's going on, even if it's difficult, can then respond to it as full human beings. But if you either fight reality and or just avoid even thinking about it, you're not going to be empowered. So the whole point of the book is to help people be empowered and to trust their own common sense. I would be really curious, what did you do to make that experience a sacred experience?
I mean, in the case, and I actually will give the doctors and nurses a lot of the credit. Once my mother went on to Comfort Care, and we knew we weren't going to move her anywhere, she was in a hospital, and she was in a private room, and there were candles set up, and there were places for the family to sit, and there was a large enough bed for us to sit on and to hold her hand and to be with her, and that was just beautiful. And they did a beautiful job of combing her hair and washing her hair and making sure that she was beautiful as well as she passed. And I think those were the moments. And for us as a Catholic family, there was a religious aspect as well. So it was a meaningful experience.
Yes, and very much exactly what you have said. People hold weddings in intensive care units so that the mother can be present before she dies when it's impossible for her to live long enough to be there for the official wedding. I really strongly suggest that people bring those battery-operated candles in, such as you experienced, ask for a private room, make sure that the telemetry is turned off. There's no need for monitors and beeps.
Right.
Turn off the television. Sometimes people have a formal rite of passage, such as the last rites in the Catholic Church or the Anglican Church. A volunteer chaplain did that with me and my dad when my dad was dying. It was so meaningful, even though I'm a Buddhist and he had not gone to church for anything but a wedding and a funeral in a very long time. But it had deep meaning. Yeah. Other people improvise their own rituals, their own goodbyes. There's a story in the book about some people taking over an intensive care unit, in essence, and queuing up songs on the dying man's playlist and so that they could listen to his music as he was dying, and they all had their hands on his body as he was dying. And the nurses in the unit were extremely cooperative, but I think it's important to ask if things are going in a way that seems too technological and there doesn't seem to be space for you. Just ask. You may not get everything you want, but if you ask, often they will really try.
We're just about out of time, but to end, of course, we're talking a lot about the aging process, but there are the accidental horrific deaths that happen to us at any stage of life. And is it still possible to die well under those tragic circumstances?
I think it is. There's a story in the book from a paramedic who, when people are dying by the side of the road, tells them the truth. He said it was not his job to comfort them with his lies. He said people are usually calm and accepting, but they often have regrets and they want to be forgiven. They want to have a sense that their life was meaningful, and they want to have a sense that they'll be remembered. And I think we can offer that kind of reassurance to people, no matter what the circumstances, and that you can always just be the one calm person in the room, the one person who's just holding the hand and not in a state of panic about something. Each one of us can do something to make this a better passage for someone. A lot of it is trusting our best instincts.
The book is beautiful. It is
Thank you.
The Art of Dying Well, A Practical Guide to a Good End of Life. The book is published by Scribner. Katie Butler, a great pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. Take care.
Again, the name of the book is The Art of Dying Well by Katie Butler. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.